Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. This week, chaos on the border and family separation. After blaming Democrats and denying he could stop it, President Trump signed an executive order to do just that. But 2,300 children remain separated from their parents. House Republicans delayed a vote on a compromise immigration bill last night after efforts to pass a hardline bill failed.
On this vote, the yeas are 193 and the nays are 231. The bill is not passed.
UN Ambassador Nikki Haley says the U.S. will withdraw from the UN's Human Rights Council.
The world's most inhumane regimes continue to escape scrutiny. And the council continues politicizing and scapegoating of countries with positive human rights records in an attempt to distract from the abusers in their ranks.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us on air or online. Do you understand this administration's immigration policy? What do you make of the fact that 2,300 kids are still separated from their families? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Arlington, Virginia is Lisa Desjardins. She's correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. And Lisa, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And with us from Washington is Kevin Diaz. He's Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Kevin, great to have you as well.
Hey, Anthony. Good to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us, On Point News Analyst. Hello, Jack. Is Jack Beatty with us? Not yet, perhaps. There you are. We got you, Jack.
Yeah, hi. Sorry.
Good to have you, Jack, and happy Friday to all of you. So let's begin, obviously, with the big story, immigration and the chaos surrounding what happened this week. First, I want to begin with the most recent news that the U.S. is preparing to shelter as many as 20,000 unaccompanied migrant children on four American bases. And Lisa, let me start with you and help me understand this. Are these children who are already here in the U.S., or is this an effort to accommodate more unaccompanied children in the future?
The understanding that we have right now is this includes future children. But to be honest, we have more questions than answers. So I don't have a definitive take on that, but I have talked to sources on Capitol Hill who believe this is just for the future as well as for children who are here now.
Right. And what are your big questions about this policy?
Where to start? I'll try and give the headlines quickly. First, we don't know that this policy has actually been implemented yet. It technically has taken effect, but there is an implementation phase. So we don't know if at every point children are now being detained with their parents or if some children are still being separated. That's question number one. Question number two is we don't know how long this policy will last. After 20 days under current law, the United States is not supposed to detain these children. So if they are detained with their parents after 20 days, will this administration breach that law? Will they release those families or will they separate them again? And then there's the long-term future of this policy, which is also has very large questions to it and whether Congress will act. So I think we have question marks all the way around.
Lots of questions. Kevin, I'd love to get you to chime in on this as well. What are you making of this policy and where does it lead us? What questions do you have about it?
Well, I think clearly what we're seeing here is that the president has been forced to wing it. He did not plan on having to back down on this family separation policy, but the public outcry, I think, forced his hand. So now you've got an entire federal bureaucracy trying to react to that. And so that's the here in Washington, I think the main question is, you know, of course, you know, everybody sees things here in terms of, you know, how's this going to play politically and what's this going to do to the November midterm elections and the control of Congress. And right now, the Democrats are totally on the offensive and the Republicans are scrambling to figure out how they're going to play it going forward, particularly given that it is not likely that they're going to be able to maintain this policy because, as Lisa pointed out, right now, the president's hands are, in a sense, tied. They can't hold these kids in indefinite detention,
right,
with or without their parents.
Well, I want to go back and talk a little bit about some of the big news that happened this week around this issue. President Trump, of course, signing an executive order 2 days ago that he says ends his policy of separating children from their parents at the southern border. But the results of his zero tolerance policy is still that more than 2,300 children remain separated from their parents. And we're going to talk about that. But here's President Trump during his cabinet meeting yesterday, again blaming Democrats for the illegal immigration crisis at the southern border, accusing them of creating what he called a massive child smuggling industry.
The only real solution is for Congress to close the catch and release loopholes that have fueled the child smuggling industry. The Democrats are causing tremendous damage and destruction and lives by not doing something about this. And they know that.
Jack Beatty, we've all been following this, trying to make sense of this chaotic week in the news around immigration. What did you take away from it?
Well, Anthony, yesterday, Charles Krauthammer, a former colleague of mine at the New Republic and a friend, died. He was a well-known, indeed famous, conservative writer. And 2 years ago, I think he really predicted this and sort of drew a line, a moral line, under Mr. Trump's character. He wrote this: Trump has a shocking absence of elementary decency and of natural empathy for the most profound of human sorrows, parental grief. And that is was such a damning assessment then. I think it must have been written about Keza Khan and the Gold Star family. But it seems to be true. I mean, Mr. Trump's week has been an example of mendacity, reckless mendacity, blaming the Democrats again, claiming on the one hand, my hands are tied, and then the next day untying his hands. And all of that to cover up this really gratuitous cruelty at the border. Gratuitous, because as the experts say, we used to have about 1.33 million. I think the figure was that around 2000. That was a high point for illegal immigration, people coming across the border without papers. It is now about 300,000 to 400,000. So there isn't a crisis in numbers. There may be a slight fluorescence with people at this moment, and the offense is ridiculously minor, according to analysis by USA Today. Typically, these parents are going to be sentenced to the time they spent in jail and a $10 fee, and then sent back to the immigration authorities for deportation. $10. So this is like a parking ticket. And for this, we're undergoing this really national disgrace seeing children pulled from their parents.
Well, we've got some comments from folks, both who are calling in, but here's a listener who wrote to us on Facebook, a listener who calls himself Honesty or herself Honesty. What this country needs is an honest discussion regarding illegal immigration that recognizes the problem with illegal immigrants. Juveniles has long preceded Trump, not the demagoguery of Democrats and left-wing media who brand all of those who oppose illegal immigration and open borders as xenophobes and racists. So some comments there on our Facebook page. I want to play a piece of tape from California Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell, who told CNN this morning that he's not aware of any federal tracking system for the children separated from their families, and says that legislation needs to wait until they've been reunited. Here we go.
We shouldn't do anything legislatively until we can reconnect these children. That has to be our highest priority right now. No child should go to sleep this evening away from their parents. And that is a moral responsibility we have. That's a human responsibility we have.
Lisa, I want to come to you on this. More than 2,300 children remain separated from their parents, and there's real concern that they could remain separated for a long time. Is there any organized policy by the Trump administration to reunite them with their families?
If there is, we don't know about it. And journalists have been asking that question for many days. What we know right now is that there is confusion between the agencies over what the policy is at this moment. And we also know from attorneys and some in the courts who have been handling these cases that at least in some cases, perhaps in many or all cases, there has not been a real effort to, once the child is separated, make sure that the next agency that handles that child, which is usually Department of Health and Human Services, know that that is a child who is separated from a parent versus the other children they shelter who came by themselves. And one of the important differences there is the unaccompanied minor children, we saw that starting in the Obama administration, are generally older. They're generally teenagers, able to get across the border themselves. These children who've been separated include very young children, but yet we are hearing that there has not been a structured way of identifying those children as they move to the next agency and making sure that their file, that their case is attached to their parents' case. And that is a very large problem for weeks and months to come.
Yeah, Kevin, I mean, some of the sort of chaos around this that was reported on NPR this week and elsewhere is once these children end up, some of these children are ending up in a foster care system. They come into contact with state laws. Meanwhile, their parents might well be sent back to Guatemala, for example. I mean, just the thicket of trying to reunite, the legal thicket and legislative thicket, administrative thicket, excuse me, of trying to reunite these families just seems daunting.
Yeah, I think what's particularly scary is that, you know, we're talking about siloed bureaucracies here. And at the very point of detention, you know, paperwork starts to be filed. And if there are any bureaucratic errors or the policemen don't or the officers don't get the right information down, some of these kids could very easily fall through the cracks and perhaps not find their parents for a long, long time, if ever.
If ever. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Are you frustrated that Congress can't figure out what to do about immigration? How would you vote on this issue? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're looking at the week in the news. You can join the conversation. If the president keeps sending conflicting messages on immigration and Congress can't figure it out, what is the answer? I'm talking with Houston Chronicle Washington correspondent Kevin Diaz, PBS NewsHour correspondent Lisa Desjardins, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And panelists, let's take some calls. We've got a lot of them lined up who want to get in on this conversation. Let's start with Carl, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you very much. I can't help but be horrified at the evil that's being presented in front of us on this policy. It's borderline satanic. And before anyone says, well, you're being hyperbolic, you're being melodramatic, I mean, stop and think about this for a minute. You had Corey Lewandowski, the campaign manager of Donald Trump, mocking a 10-year-old girl with Down syndrome. You had Kirstjen Nielsen, Homeland Security Secretary. A woman of means can eat wherever she wants. She goes to a Mexican restaurant. You have Melania Trump yesterday wearing a jacket that says, I don't care, do you? purposely put this jacket on. This is a woman of means. She's never had to wear something like this, probably never worn anything like that in her adult life. It reeks of evil.
Carl, we hear your outrage. We know it's shared out there by a lot of people. I want to pick up on at least a couple of things you're talking about. Lisa, I want to start with you. You know, we do have to talk about First Lady Melania Trump's visit to a Texas detention center holding unaccompanied children. First of all, before we talk about that jacket, which I'm not sure I really wanted to do, but I don't think I can avoid it. Tell us about this visit and what the First Lady was hoping to accomplish.
Absolutely. This was not an announced visit, though it had been planned apparently for a couple of days. The First Lady went to what is actually a relatively small shelter. We're told it's about 55 kids. There's mixed reporting on how many of those kids have been separated from their parents. It seems like not all of them, perhaps a small amount of them, not clear. I think she mainly wanted to show a compassionate side to this administration. She spoke with some of the children, and she said she wanted to know what she could do to help the children.
Right. Now, we understand that she felt differently, perhaps, than her president husband on this issue. I mean, what do we know? I'll ask you, Kevin or Lisa, about this. Is there really a rift between the president and the First Lady on this?
I don't think we really know. That's between them. But it is, you know, this is one of the strangest things I've seen in more than two decades of covering Washington politics. Because, I mean, clearly, you know, as Lisa said, the point of this trip was to go and show a compassionate side to this administration. The question for me is, did they think that somehow this jacket helped that? I mean, was it? Did they think about it? Did they think it sent some kind of a message, you know, like Trump saying, well, it was really meant to be a big finger to the press, the fake media?
And Kevin, let me just jump in, because for listeners who might not recall or know, the jacket said, I don't care, do you? And it was an off-the-rack jacket. But there were the words and lots of people scratching their heads and wondering about the significance of them. But go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I really don't care, do you? Yeah. Capital U. You just have to think that maybe there was no thought put into it at all. That would be the scariest scenario for me, it just didn't occur to anybody, either to her or any of her handlers. And believe me, these people don't just go out there on their own, you know, shooting from the hip. I mean, you know, they're surrounded by staff. I mean, it shocks me that, you know, Stephanie or nobody else working around the First Lady, you know, stopped her and said, is this really the image you want to portray?
And it's just really
bizarre.
Yeah, go ahead.
To ring in on that, I had those same questions too. Is this some kind of haphazard, strange oddity? And then I realized, as Kevin probably realized too, it is summer in Washington. It is hot. There is not a need to wear a jacket like that. And Stephanie Grisham, who Kevin referenced, is the First Lady's spokesperson, initially told reporters, it's just a jacket. There's no hidden message. Well, yeah, there wasn't a hidden message. There was a very public message. And as you all have said, the president later tweeted that this was a message to the media and about fake news. The First Lady wore it not just on her way there, but she wore it when she returned to Washington and after press reports had raised a lot of questions. So she clearly was trying to send some kind of message. You know, was it to the press? Was it to the president? Was it about this issue? It certainly distracted from her trip. And that sort of is the bigger issue for this administration, I think. And she had to know it. She's someone who has used fashion and her walk on and off airplanes, I think, with great purpose in the past. Mm.
Let's take another call. Troy is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Troy, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. Please go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, why doesn't the press report that Obama did the exact same thing? And if you go to Google and talk about immigrant kids or Google immigrant kids Obama, you will actually see the exact same pictures that you guys reported that these are Trump pictures. They were actually Obama pictures.
Now, wait a minute, Troy. I want to just stop you. I want you to be specific. When you say that the Obama administration did the exact same thing, what are you referring to specifically?
The Obama administration took kids away from foreigners that were illegally crossing into the United States.
Okay, so here's what we understand about that, and I actually want to put that to my panelists. Lisa, let me start with you on this. My understanding is that the Obama administration considered child separation, but then came out against it. Perhaps what Troy is referring to is there were unaccompanied minors who came to the border without their parents, so they were already separated before they got to this country. But enlighten Troy or put this into some kind of perspective.
All of this is true, but it's a question of degrees. And we have reported this, I know, on NewsHour and other outlets, but I understand where Troy is coming from because the overwhelming majority of the story has been focused on what's happening now. But the Obama administration did, in fact, separate some families at the border. That was, by and large, the exception. And we were told that those were some families who there were particular concerns about the adults who were involved. Mm-hmm. What's the change now, which is a dramatic change, is that it is not the exception, it is the rule. And it is not just those who are found undocumented, but it is also those who are applying for asylum, which is a legal process and a right that is kind of the U.S. has agreed to and the United Nations upholds. So it's not just those who are undocumented coming as families, but asylum seekers as well. Those are major changes. So you're having any family, basically, who is not in this country legally now and wants to be at the border has been separated by this policy. That is very different from the Obama administration. Troy is correct that the Obama administration did separate some families, but it was the exception.
Got it. Troy, thanks for that call. We appreciate you putting that perspective out there. Let's go to Harriet, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Go ahead, Harriet. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Sure, President Obama did separate, but he also had a plan in place that kept these families together, that did not lose the babies that could not speak for themselves and say, this is my mother and she's in this facility. This president has separated babies, children who don't speak English, and they don't have the ability to know where their parents are, to reconnect. We may never have these children go back home. They'll grow up in foster homes. They'll be mentally damaged because they've been taken away. I don't know if anyone saw, well, surely everyone probably saw, where that poor boy, after being away from his parents just for 8 months, was reunited. He is going to now be torn with his American family, the love that they shared for him in that short time. And yet, when he saw his father, it looked as though he saw a stranger. I am hurt by this administration, how careless that they've been with other people's children, because I promise this president's children would never have been separated without some ability to reunite them. Shame on our country. Either you let them in and you do it the right way, or you give the, and they have the right to be here if they are seeking asylum.
That's true, Harriet, and we hear your passion and we appreciate it. Thank you for the call. Jack Beatty, I mean, one of the things I'm hearing and reminded of in Harriet's call is the sort of long-term implications of what happened this week. It's not going to go away overnight.
For the children, earlier this week, we had a pediatrician, in fact, I think leading a person in pediatrics, saying, you know, essentially saying that this is going to go on and on. This will reverberate in all sorts of ways through the lives of these children. This is a cruelty that will last. And you know, this question of will they be reunited? Well, today's reporting has a reporter spoke to lawyers representing 400 parents down there, and these lawyers representing 400 parents have been able to contact only two of their children.
Right. Well, speaking of a pediatrician, let's go to Dawn. She's calling from Lexington, Virginia. And Dawn, I understand you're a retired pediatrician. Give us your take on what you saw and are thinking about this week.
Okay. I just want to take the conversation out of the politics for a minute. And the voice that I don't hear a lot of is focusing on the trauma to the children that's going to continue across a lifetime. There's been a lot of focus on the in-the-moment pain of the parents and the young child upon separation. But I'm concerned about attachment and grounding for these children in trust. And I think once that is violated, it has life long implications, and I think that we are creating a population of children who over the long run will have struggles that they're going to have to deal with that will impact every adult in our country forever. I mean, these are cross-generational traumas that can't be taken lightly.
Mm. Dawn, thanks so much for that call. We really, really appreciate it. Lisa, Kevin, Jack, I want to sort of stick with this subject, but move on to congressional action or attempted congressional action. Congress has been trying to pass immigration reform legislation, but so far with no luck. This week, a conservative GOP plan to overhaul immigration failed to pass yesterday. A more moderate compromise bill was pushed off until next week. Kevin, can you sort of bring us up to date about congressional efforts and what we might expect to happen or not happen on Monday?
Sure. Bringing us up to the moment, President Trump just told Republicans in Congress that they're wasting their time, that he doesn't think that they're going to be able to get anything through and doesn't think they should even try until after the elections. Now, I don't know if that's a calculation that he thinks that they'll pick up more votes in November, or if he just thinks that this is just bad politics for Republicans and it's best to just drop the matter. But as things stand, Republicans yesterday afternoon, after the defeat of the conservative alternative, you know, there were two GOP-drafted bills. So the conservative one goes up first, it fails. Then they're ready to present what's being characterized as a compromise, which is just we're talking about a compromise in and among Republicans because all the Democrats are uniformly opposed. Now it looks like they've put that the first they put it off until later in the day yesterday, then they put it off until today, and now they've put it off until next week. And it seems to me the momentum seems to be going in the direction of no action on,
right,
on this legislation.
And what would that moderate bill do? For example, on I guess the key issues are family separation, on DACA, on the so-called Dreamers, and border security. Would it address these three things in some significant way?
Yeah, the bill is really just a modified version of the compromise bill I'm talking about now. It's a modified version of the one that failed yesterday. It supposedly covers the four pillars that President Trump set out when this whole issue was being hashed out by the Senate a few months ago. The most important thing and the most objectionable thing for Democrats is that it provides about $25 billion for Trump's wall. You know, he finally gets his wall. In exchange for that, he makes some concessions on the Dreamers, the DACA recipients. It's not as large a number as the Democrats would like. I think it would provide some protection for about 1.1 or 1.2 million young people. But it doesn't provide them a special path to citizenship. What it does is it provides them temporary residency. They get visa, six-year visas, I think it is. And that makes them eligible at some point in the future to apply for citizenship, just like anybody else. The Democrats, of course, were looking for a more direct path. But yeah, it does the compromise bill, the leadership bill, whatever they're calling it, does deal with the family separations by trying to mandate that they can have these indefinite detentions. In other words, keep the kids with the parents while they're going through these legal proceedings. And this is proving to be even more unpopular. Well, I shouldn't say that. As unpopular with the Democrats and a lot of immigrant advocates as the family separation policy.
Yeah. So, Lisa, I'm struck by news from Kevin. I mean, that he just reported this idea that President Trump is saying, you know, pulling his support away from voting on this bill right away. This is something we're hearing from members of his own from his own party, that they don't know where the president stands on what they're trying to accomplish legislatively.
Yeah, just this morning, the president again tweeting out that he thinks that there is no point to action in the House. This is just a couple days after the president had an evening meeting. They called a special meeting for House Republicans to meet with the president. House leaders were thinking he will rally them together. We will unify. And most Republicans walked out of that meeting feeling somewhat optimistic, but they weren't sure about what, because the president didn't say exactly what he would support. This, I think, is a critical problem in the entire immigration debate. The president says he wants congressional action, but this week is not the first time he has taken the legs out of any potential compromise. The Senate came very close earlier this year to a possible deal, and it was the president who at the last minute said he wouldn't support it. It is more and more obvious that Republicans in Congress are taking their cues from this president rather than looking to the option of passing something and trying to force his hand. Mm. They are waiting for him, and he is giving them little direction.
We're coming up on a break in about 30 seconds, but Kevin, I wanted to ask you very quickly before we go to the break about a piece that you wrote this week with a headline, Trump Immigration Policies Endanger Texas Republicans Ahead of Midterm Elections. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the challenge faced by folks in Texas trying to hold on to their seats?
Yeah, in brief, you've got about two or three Republicans in Texas who represent districts that fell to Hillary, so therefore our targets. This whole immigration issue, particularly for Will Hurd, who represents the biggest borderline district in the country, 800 miles of the border in West Texas, and it's a heavily Latino district, and so he needs to be careful how he plays this, and he's been very critical of the Trump administration policy.
All right. We're discussing this week's biggest news stories, and there's lots to discuss. You can join the conversation. Did the Supreme Court get it right on gerrymandering? We're going to be talking about that after the break. What about online shopping sales taxes? What about the pushback from countries on Trump's tariffs? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. In other news this week, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that states can require online retailers to collect sales taxes. Here's CBS's Jan Crawford.
The opinion today really sets out that the internet revolution has changed everything and that these retailers, for all accounts and purposes, actually do have a real and meaningful presence.
After battling cancer, longtime conservative commentator Charles Krauthammer died yesterday. Here he is on Fox News on Election Day 2016, predicting the future of the Republican Party under President Trump.
The most obvious issues are going to be immigration and trade. This will be a new party. It'll be a populist party.
And he got that right. And Beyonce and Jay-Z dropped a surprise new album this week. Here's the lead single from a music video filmed in the Louvre in Paris. Step my money fast and go. You can join the conversation. Is President Trump doubling down on an unwinnable trade war? Is attorney Michael Cohen about to flip? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me is Lisa Desjardins from PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle's Kevin Diaz, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And folks, I want to talk about tariffs. Let's talk about what seems to be a growing global trade war. The European Union has imposed more than $3 billion in tariffs on American products. This in response to U.S. tariffs on foreign aluminum and steel. And here's President Trump during his cabinet meeting yesterday strongly criticizing U.S. trade deals.
They're out of control how bad they are, but we're going to make them very good. And we're going to make them fair for both countries, for our country and for whichever country we're dealing with. And there are plenty of them because they're all bad. There's nothing good.
Jack Beatty, want to come to you, start with you on this part of the conversation. What do you make of what seems to be a growing trade war that Donald Trump seems to be doing a lot to fuel here?
Yes, and it's a war against American jobs and American consumers, or at least that's what Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, heard this week. In a hearing, he heard that from Republican senators. Senator Thune complained, corn, wheat, beef, and pork all suffering market price declines. Senator Grassley, we watched the soybean market start to collapse because of these trade war stuff. Senator Portman, auto and steel auto producers in Ohio hit harder than any other state by the Canadian retaliatory tariffs. From Pennsylvania, Heinz ketchup. No, they're going to get retaliatory tariffs. From Georgia, Johnny Isaacson complaining about Coca-Cola's rising aluminum can costs. Mr. Trump, practicing really 18th century economics, is taking on, seems to be taking on the rest of the world, China too, but also the American consumer and American jobs. Everybody agrees that, as all economists agree, this is going to cost far more jobs than it creates, and it's going to boost prices for almost all American consumers.
Well, here's a tweet from President Trump that's just come out. Based on the tariffs and trade barriers long placed on the U.S. and its great companies and workers by the European unions, if these tariffs and barriers are not soon broken down and removed, we will be placing a 20% tariff on all of their cars coming into the U.S. Build them here. Kevin Diaz, where do you see this going? Is there a path toward reconciliation here?
I don't know. Could we change the topic? Because this business about a trade war is really going to do damage to my retirement account. And no, that is the concern of Republicans, especially in Texas, which is a very free trade kind of a state. I mean, agriculture and ports, particularly in Houston. And what a lot of Republican lawmakers, people who have stuck with Trump on everything from immigration to the refugee crisis and all the rest of, on this, they're breaking with him because they're really worried that this talk of a trade war, you can see what it's been doing to the stock market, is going to offset the benefits that they saw of the Republican tax cuts. Right ahead of the midterm elections in November. So they're very worried about this.
Well, yesterday, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross told CNBC that rising tensions in trade negotiations between the U.S. and the rest of the world will help lower trade barriers for American companies. Here's what he said.
What we have to do is create an environment where it's more painful for these parties that have these huge trade barriers, both tariff and non-tariff. Got to make it more painful for them to keep those barriers than to get rid of them.
Lisa, let me come to you. I mean, and yet here we are, European tariffs are designed to hit products that target President Trump's political base, bourbon, motorcycles, Florida orange juice. Does Trump run a risk of paying a political price for this? What's your view?
Oh, absolutely. It is a matter of time. If these tariffs continue, we will especially see, in addition to those you named, the agriculture sector really have a problem. And I'm already hearing from many very conservative, very pro-Trump lawmakers who say they are worried because their farmers are worried. We've seen in the last week soybean futures drop to their lowest level, I think, in 9 years. And that's already hitting farmers' bottom line right now. And when you look at those states that are affected, soybean, sorghum also is another crop that was affected very early. That's a big crop in Kansas. I think that that community, which voted in large part for Mr. Trump, is now very concerned. There's a sense that, hey, this is going to work out. We trust him. But there's now questions as to, will it work out? How much time it takes for how much hit it takes on those communities is the test. And I think in another couple months, we're going to see very serious problems. Also, the automotive sector, we've already seen just today on that announcement that you mentioned, the stocks for GM and Ford drop. And they've got a real problem as well.
Really interesting subject that we'll continue to monitor. I want to move on and talk about gerrymandering and about the Supreme Court and two cases on partisan gerrymandering. One involves a challenge to a redistricting plan from the Republican legislature in Wisconsin. The other, a Republican challenge to a Democratic plan to redraw a Maryland congressional district. In both cases, the court declined to address the central issue. So, Kevin Diaz, is this the court sort of kicking the can down the road, essentially? What do you take away from this decision?
Well, it is in the case of political gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering. But there's a case coming out of Texas that hasn't been addressed yet by the Supreme Court, and we're expecting a decision or ruling any day now, that has to deal with racial gerrymandering. There's a case out of Texas that alleges that the Republican legislature was purposely trying to dilute the voting strength of Latinos and black folks in the state of Texas. It's interesting, I think, that when the Supreme Court punted on Maryland and Wisconsin, they didn't roll this Texas case into that. So it suggests to me that they're looking at it through a slightly different prism. And so racial gerrymandering might actually be get different treatment than just straight-up political gerrymandering. Mm,
that'll be interesting to watch. Let's take a couple of calls on this subject. Nate is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, it's good to have you. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I see gerrymandering as very much rigged elections, where our state legislature here in Wisconsin does not reflect the will of the people, and it's the same way in a number of other states like Michigan, Florida, North Carolina, where we found out through this court case that they had basically promised a certain political party that they would have minimum number of seats no matter what the voters decided, no matter what the voters wanted, and this was very much on purpose. So right now I don't feel like we have an elected legislature here for our state, and that's something that can bleed up to the House of Representatives as well, which people are going to be looking at this fall.
Nate, thanks so much for that call. Let me go to Linda, who's calling on the same subject from Tampa, Florida. Linda, good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to obviously remind everyone that that's why we don't have any compromise in the Congress, is because we have gerrymandering, which produces all these extremists, and they don't have to compromise with anyone, and therefore we don't get anything done. And our president perpetuates that by addressing only his base. What about the rest of us? He represents all of us, not just his 30%. And I'm sorry to go off topic for a second, but how does the First Lady, even if she was poking an eye in the media, that's not her position. We need the media and the press.
Linda, I get it, and I'm glad you appreciate your final thought there on the First Lady. I'm going to stick with gerrymandering just because we're trying to move a little more deeply into that subject, so I appreciate your call. I want to take one more from Adam, who's calling from Boston. Go ahead, Adam. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. So I want to echo a little bit of what the previous caller said, but I also want to make the comment that I don't think the gerrymandering story is covered well enough. I think it's the single most important story of the week, if not the year, because gerrymandering does make it impossible for moderates to get elected to Congress and people who really represent the interests of their district, or of what would be their district if they weren't gerrymandering. And I think that the media is kind of wonky, of course, and it doesn't lead, but I think it's really, really important.
Adam, I'm going to jump in just because your line is really difficult to understand, but I took away the point of what you're saying. And Jack, let me come to you on this. I mean, there's Adam talking about gerrymandering as being the most important story out there, or one of the most important stories out there that is not covered well, but it sort of underlies so much of the political dysfunction that we have in this country. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think he's on to something, and I'd like to see some studies on how states that use commissions, I think Iowa is the outstanding example, how much more competitive their congressional elections are than in states that have partisan gerrymandering. So it can be done. Reforms can be made. However, you know, the Senate is not gerrymandered, and the Senate is as, perhaps it isn't as polarized as the House. But the rural-urban split, the conservative-liberal split, is very strong in the Senate, and the political fear of the Trump base that keeps House Republicans loyal to Mr. Trump, senators feel that too. So I wish it was something as simple as dealing with, not that it's simple, but I wish it was something as mechanical as fixing districts would save us from polarization. However, I think the polarization is among the people, not just the politicians.
Well, Lisa, final thought for you, from you on gerrymandering. I mean, of course, gerrymandering is sort of both parties have played a big role in this fine political tradition going back a long way. But right. What's your view here?
I think where we are now, gerrymandering will continue. And it means state houses and who controls them are as important as ever.
Yeah. Let me move on in the few minutes that remain and talk about Michael Cohen, President Trump's former longtime lawyer. This week, he resigned from his post as National Deputy Finance Chairman of the Republican National Committee, saying the investigation into his contacts with Russia and his business dealings were too much of a distraction. Mr. Cohen also interestingly criticized the Trump administration's policy of separating immigrant families at the southern border. Lisa, let me come to you first. What's the significance of this? And there are other layers to this story as well.
Well, many are wondering if Mr. Cohen, who is clearly under quite a lot of investigative heat and potentially pressure, is going to turn and testify against his longtime employer, Mr. Trump. And it was unusual for him to so openly break with Mr. Trump on anything. Now, as part of that letter, he also indicated that the scrutiny he's under was another reason that he is leaving the RNC. But he went out of his way to criticize the child separation policy, and many people are wondering if that's a signal. But I think the other thing to watch, and I know this show has covered this in the past, is this idea that perhaps the Trump administration wants Mr. Cohen and others to feel that they could get a pardon later on. That's something that Rudy Giuliani and the president himself have seemed to signal. And it's wonder if there's a question here if Mr. Cohen is trying to send a message back in this letter. Who knows? It's very unclear. But there are increasing tea leaves. We're not sure what they mean.
Jack, what are you reading in these tea leaves?
Well, it was I was frankly a little moved by Mr. Cohen's statement. He said that he is the son of Holocaust survivors, and this just the separation of families at the border just seemed to him unspeakably odious because of that historical echo. So I say good for him for having a scruple. And this comes the week, you know, when we're getting some light on the possible connection between Russia and the Trump and Mr. Trump. The McClatchy reports that investigated $109 million worth of cash sales. It made 86 of them made in the within a short period of time, 207 to 210 in Florida and in New York, cash sales to Russian cash buyers, and people are saying, wait a minute, is this money laundering? This has to be looked into.
Right.
The question are we going to find out more about that?
Kevin, as the clock runs down, we've got about 20 seconds left here. If Michael Cohen were to flip, fairly significant there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't really cover the Michael Cohen story, but as far as his comments about the family separations, that's no profile in courage. I mean, everybody is saying that now. I mean, those words are even coming out of the president's mouth, frankly. But where this goes, as the president says, we'll see.
We'll see indeed. Kevin Diaz, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, thank you so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
My pleasure.
And Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Always great to have you. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Oh, thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, you too. Great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. This is On Point.